the jurisdiction.
Open the House Committee on Agriculture and Land Use. Today is February the 12th, 2019. And I just want to let folks know who are here for House Bill 2061 that in deference to my fabulous vice chair to my left, we need some more time for this, so we're not going to be doing the hearing on this today, and I'll get back to you at some later date. Sorry for the late notice. Hopefully there's at least one other bill you came here for, folks, but everyone seems happy about that. Good. Okay, then. So when people leave, it doesn't mean they're not interested. It just means they're not here on other bills. And they have other things to go do. So let's start with Representative Witt's bill. House Bill, let me open a public hearing on House Bill 2729. We'll have Representative Witt tell us about the need for some cash.
Ooh.
We need greenbacks.
This is a cocktail. Alan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brad Witt, State Representative, House District 31. And that green stuff will be an investment in this bill.
That's right.
So I'm appearing today in support of House Bill 2729. And my understanding is that I have a very limited amount of time. It's just a bill introduction. So let me just say that the bill requests $10 million. It is an investment in agriculture in Oregon. Why should we be so interested in ag? Ag is a huge percentage of our state's economy and a huge percentage of our state's land mass, about 25% in both instances. This land is all about natural resources. It is all about wildlife. It's all about wildlife habitat. It's all about fish. It's all about clean water. It is all about a plethora of natural resources, from plants on down to critical habitats for endangered species. It is also an economic driver in our state. This bill attempts to meld the interests of the farming community in terms of preserving farmlands for farming and preserving those lands out into the future for habitat, for fish, wildlife, and a host of natural resources. The bill does so by providing for staff and following up on a bill from last session, making it possible for folks to plan for keeping farms in farming, transitions for generational transfer of the farmlands, and making sure that it's kept whole rather than in being fragmented, so that it is fragmentation is the enemy of both habitat as well as efficient farming. It does so through providing easements, covenants, and estate plannings so that as lands transfer, farmers are averaging about 60 years of age currently. About two-thirds of these farms are expected to change hands in the next couple of decades. There is a severe risk that these lands could go to alternative usages. This bill makes it possible then to take those lands which were provided for and then use them not only for farmland, but as I said, protecting our state's natural resources. The investment part of this, I mentioned the request is $10 million. The secret is there are literally tens of millions of dollars out there that folks both in the federal sector as well as the private sector are willing to provide in terms of match to enable states who are looking to protect farmlands and looking to protect this this habitat. They are willing to provide money to assist in that process. States that have a match come out with 65% greater return on their invested funds because of the donations and because of the grants that they're able to achieve. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is an opportunity for us to further not only agricultural interests and habitat interests. It's an opportunity for our state to begin receiving a lot more money than it currently does, because we just can't be the player that the other states already are. I urge your favorable action on House Bill 2729. Realize that my time is out, but would be happy to answer questions if you so choose, or defer to those who will be following me.
Questions for our colleague, the Honorable Chair of the Natural Resources Committee, Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Witt, I wanted to just say thank you again for your stalwart looking out for ag in Oregon. I always appreciate that. For as few years as I've known you, that's the one thing that just really stands out, and I appreciate that. And to be able to put something together like this, if you can get me to sign on to a bill that asks for money, that's a big deal. And you didn't even have to sell me. And so I appreciate that, because I think this is exciting to look at, and the possibilities of the things that you talked about, and funds, matching funds and grants and whatnot. So I just wanted to get on the record. Thank you for bringing this to our attention.
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Post, thank you very much. I appreciate those kind words. Thank you.
Anybody else from somewhere?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to ask Bruce Taylor and Maida Lofsgaarden to come up.
Members of the committee, for the record, Maida Lofsgaarden, Executive Director with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. I've brought along with me Liz Redon, who is one of our regional program managers, in part because if you have any really serious questions, she's the ones who can answer them for you. She helped facilitate this process and has run similar processes with our agency. Also, Vice Chair of the Oregon Agriculture Heritage Commission, Bruce Taylor, who will be speaking at the end. So you have heard a great feedback about the program from Representative Witt. You already had a hearing on the policy side of the program last week. So what I'd like to do is just very quickly move into some of the questions that have come up about how this funding, if it moved forward, would be implemented. So just a few slides that I have here to walk through that, and then I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. Representative Witt already spoke about this overview, why the program is of interest in the state. I do want to just put up a reminder of who the members of the commission are. This, without question, is one of the most amazing groups of people I've worked with. And they went into incredible detail based on the statute that you all passed in the last session to put together a set of rules that will really govern how this program is implemented if funding is provided for it. And it, again, it's a mix of fish and wildlife interests, agriculture, land, and tribal interests and other natural resource interests, along with experts in extension and other areas. I want to note this because I'm going to come back to it later when I talk about what our technical review process will look like. It's going to look a lot reflective to what you see at the level of the commission. So a reminder, the fund request has four areas. The development of many of them we don't talk about. We often focus on the working land covenants and easements component. That's the big ticket item, but also conservation management plans, technical assistance, and succession planning. So one of the questions that we were asked to respond to is, why would a farmer participate in the Oregon Agriculture Heritage Program? They could make a whole lot of money just selling their property, especially if it jumps inside later an urban growth boundary, or even at the level it's at as a recreational or hunting or other interest. So why would they even want to participate? The first reminder is that there are three programs for landowners, and we heard loud and clear that succession planning was critically important. You all talked about that during your last hearing, so I won't go into more detail. I think you really know that piece well. The other piece is conservation plans. This is something that has long been underfunded, and the program assumed funding to help landowners develop conservation plans. The third piece, I think where the question really comes is, why would a landowner participate in a covenant or easement where they're selling their development rights, right? There are many farmers and ranchers who want to either be able to pass a property on to their children or to a neighbor or to somebody else in their community who's interested in picking up that property, and that the value to buy into that land can be pretty high when you take into consideration the development rights. Those individuals don't necessarily want to develop down the road. And so if you can buy down that development right value, you can then sell at the farm-based value. So what you're doing is putting this in a place where it becomes less expensive for somebody who might be 30 or 40 years old and is ready to take over the farm to be able to take that over and still let the parents have a retirement that they want. Because for most farmers and ranchers, their land is their retirement. So being able to pull some value out of that while they're still there is critically important. And in addition, there are landowners who are just very interested in making sure land stays as farmland. They have generations of influence and work in those areas. The biggest reminder is this program is voluntary. And so there is no interest in purchasing rights from landowners who aren't interested. The funding could never do that for all lands across the state, would never intend to. So it's a small program, it's one tool, and it's voluntary. So the other question that was asked of us is, how would you select projects if they moved forward? So I just pulled up one of those three programs. In the statute that you passed last session, you guys were very specific, working with the group of agriculture and conservation groups who helped develop the legislation. There was a very specific set of criteria that every project has to be evaluated against. That includes how it maintains or enhances farming and ranching and fish and wildlife habitat, other natural resource values, the capacity of the organization who's running the project, the benefit to the state from the investment, so what's the leverage, impacts on neighbors. So all of those criteria are required to evaluate a project. I'm gonna go into a little bit more detail about what that looks like. But the other question that was asked that I wanna make sure and respond to is, can you just pick a set of farms? Like we only want to do Willamette Valley farms, for example. The bill that was passed last session said we may not include a consideration for the type of agriculture operation. So we cannot focus just on organic lands. We cannot focus just on sage grouse in eastern Oregon. The projects have to reflect a diversity across the state while meeting those criteria. So the criteria are pretty specific.
And could we just pause for 1 second?
Yes.
Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a real quick question. You've referred several times to what we passed. Do you remember what the House bill was, or what bill it was? And was that 17 or 18 session?
Chair Clem, Vice Chair Post, it was in the 17th session, and I do not remember the number, but I will get that number for you.
Was it by chance 3249? Does that sound right?
That might be it. I remember numbers for exactly one session and think I'll remember them forever, but we will follow up on that, Vice Chair Post.
Because it's the one that established this.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's what I need to know. I think it was.
So one of the requirements of that statute was that the commission establish rules that would better flesh out these statutory requirements. So a project cannot be evaluated on anything less than this, but you can go into more detail on each of these criteria. I will not go through this, but I just want to show you what the commission once unleashed.
Yes.
To do their work around the rules, what they created. And this is where, if you have technical questions, Liz can help speak to them. But what you see in the circles are those criteria that are established by statute. What the commission then did is further flesh out, what does it mean regarding impacts of the covenant on a neighbor? That means how are you going to engage neighboring properties about how to mitigate any impacts? What are your plans for communicating with neighbors if there is a project that might have an impact? When you look down at the connection to wildlife habitat in the bottom right corner, things like protecting or improving natural resource values would be something that would bring that project up higher, protecting or improving wildlife habitats. So all of those criteria are now in rule, and projects know that what they have to do is a good enough job at hitting all nine of those that they hit that sweet spot. So there will never be a project that is just a fish and wildlife habitat project, because it would skew that towards the fish and wildlife habitat and not grab the agriculture side. Vice versa, you could never have a project be successful that was only about agriculture and didn't meet any of those criteria on the fish and wildlife side. The way that the process works, I highlighted for you just a minute ago the makeup of the commission. The commission has the authority to establish technical teams to review the grants. Those technical teams will reflect the makeup of the commission. So there might be folks from the Department of Agriculture who have expertise in ag lands, or OSU Extension who has expertise in a community. Representatives from the Department of Fish and Wildlife or local fish and wildlife agencies who understand that side. Agriculture water quality experts. All of those folks will be on a technical team that uses this rule and statutory criteria in order to select projects. This is a model that OWIB has used for many years, and it's been a very successful model. We've used it on fish and wildlife habitat, and based on our conversations with the commission, we think it will be a successful model here. They then provide those technical reviews to the policy board, who makes the final funding decision. That is then forwarded to OWIB, who has the fiscal oversight for the program. So it's a three-step review process before any project would be funded. Finally, one of the questions that was asked, and Representative Witt spoke briefly to, is to speak to, in this current bill, what is the $10 million used for? The $10 million includes $9.25 million for grants. And the remainder for administration. The statute, which I think I saw was House Bill 3249, put a 12% cap on administration for the agency, so that's why these numbers end up where they are. So the $9.25 million, the commission, just like our OEB board does, would establish a spending plan. So they would determine inside that plan how much goes for succession planning, for easements, for covenants, easements and covenants, and conservation management plans. So they have the say within that funding where the money goes. And finally, to speak to Representative Witt's comment that there are is already a broad interest. The agency back in August, as a part of our agency request budget, had put together what is the interest around the state. Without doing much advertising, there were 28 projects that came back for $38 million. This is the range of the projects. It's you also have it as a handout, and the types of commodities and the size represented, which is also represented in a table format. So that, again, as you know, this is not part of the governor's budget, but when it was in the agency request budget, that was part of the analysis that was used for that funding. So I think I will end it there. See if you have any questions for Liz or I, and then we can turn it over to Vice Chair Taylor to close.
Questions at this point for Maida? Okay.
For Liz.
Thank you, Chair Klim, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Taylor, and I've been working on bird habitat conservation across Oregon for more than 25 years. I work for two regional bird conservation partnerships. The Pacific Birds is west of the Cascades, Intermountain West Joint Venture East Side. But I'm here today as one of the Fish and Wildlife representatives on the Agricultural Heritage Commission, and I serve as the vice chair. And I won't pretend to speak for the commission, and I'm not representing them, but I am representative of the commission. They're among the smartest, most capable people I've ever met. And was a remarkable degree of consensus throughout the process. Liz and Maida could confirm that. These were really thoughtful people who really dug into the details of the rulemaking. So I think you should feel really comfortable and confident in both the rulemaking process and the caliber of the people on the commission. And since Maida covered the substance of the program so thoroughly there, I'm going to jump ahead more to the color commentary spin what comes next part of the equation there. And it's partly because I look around here, and members of this committee have been among the strongest supporters of this program in the legislature, and I certainly hope you'll vote to move the bill onward today. But beyond that, I would also like to ask you to be a champion for this proposal among your colleagues on the Ways and Means Committee, which is where a lot of really difficult decisions are going to be made this session, as they're made every session. And I think there is going to be a tendency when we get to that level for people to say, gosh, $10 million, that's a lot of money. Couldn't we just start with a million or two and see how it goes and take it from there? And I think that would be unfortunate, because this really is the kind of problems that we're talking about here, a massive change in ownership through with not always adequate succession planning in place there. You know, lands are going to change hands over the next 2 years. People are going to die, and some of those lands are going to be converted to other uses. And those are not really reversible consequences. There's no question, I don't think, that we're not going to have enough good projects out there. As Maida said, you know, $30-plus million worth of projects without even really beating the bushes at all there. You know, I think the real problem will be funding too few of them. And as a commissioner who cares about the program, my concern there is that if we fund one or two projects, with which if we have $1 or $2 million is probably what we would get, it starts to pigeonhole the program as, oh, this is for this kind of landowner or that part of the state. And I think I can speak for the commission in saying that everybody's been very clear from the beginning this needs to be a program that works statewide for agricultural landowners statewide. And the extent that we started off on the from the beginning with people having a perception, oh, this is only for landowners in the Willamette Valley, or this is for ranch owners in the High Desert of Southeast Oregon, it's going to handicap us politically, both in getting more funding, but there's also the foregone opportunities and the real losses that we're likely to see in the meantime. So I hope that you all can be champions for this and encouraging the Ways and Means Committee not to think small, but to think this is an opportunity, and we really do need to get started now. You've probably heard plenty of testimony in the past about how this is kind of a slow-moving tsunami. Well, it's about to start cresting, and we will start seeing the impacts very soon. So thank you for your time, and I hope you'll support the bill, and I hope you will encourage your colleagues to do the same. Thank you.
Questions? Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I needed to bring up and ask about the legislation that created this a couple years ago was because I want to make sure that I'm clear on this. I was a no vote on the floor. But I support this particular situation. The reason I was a no vote then, and I won't go into all the details, was because anytime I'm generally opposed to establishing something new that costs money. That's just the way I am. Now it's in place, and now it's functioning, and now we're going to improve it. So we're going to take something and make it really, really, really good. Not that it was bad before, but, you know, so I thought it would be important to point out there were, I wasn't the only one, there were 15 no's in the House and 2 in the Senate. So there were some people that were concerned about this, and for whatever reasons they were. But there's a big difference between this bill and that bill in 2017, at least for me personally. So I am excited about it, as I spoke to Representative Witt, and will encourage Ways and Means to move on this, because let's do think big. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. It's exciting to see the funding ask and get the feeling that we could get moving on this soon. My question is, in looking at our map, I'm noticing that the responding entities were, they're all entities that have some sort of structure in and of themselves for fiscal constraint and control. I guess my question is this group, do you think, just from your experience, representative of the broader group that we're likely to get requests and responses from as we move along with this program into the future?
Chair Clem, Representative Helm, I've moved us to this slide because one of the, if you look in the bottom left corner, one of the requirements is the capacity and competence of the organization, and there's a set of criteria there that requires, if it's a land trust accreditation or something similar, that there's land preservation in their mission or other documents, that there's effective governance. What you see here, when the request went out initially, we actually sent it only to land trust and soil and water conservation districts because those were the entities who already knew about the program. They are the two major entities who are eligible. Cities, counties, tribes are also, but these are the two that probably had the most relevance. And so that's why you see this list here. But one of the nice things about both the statute and the rule is that one of the things that we've learned over time running our other programs is if the organization does not have capacity, you don't see good projects at the end of the day. So it is one of our criteria. I think you'll see that in future applicants.
Just one follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
This is the kind of thing that I think we should also, advocates of this bill, should be pointing out to our friends on Ways and Means. This is a situation where we're going to get control through the granting agency, and then we're going to get control of the finances on the ground. And with these organizations, like Representative Witt noted, we'll get the multiplier effect. Those are the wheels and cogs that we need to be working to multiply the money that the state puts in, and it's already built into the bill. So this gives me great confidence. I'll be transmitting that to our friends on Ways and Means.
Further questions? Okay, let's see. Thank you, and I'm gonna ask Ivan Maluski, Peter Kanagi, and Mary Ann Cooper to come up.
I'm trying to send you those pictures, and I'm just not going through. I'm gonna email them, I guess.
Yeah.
Ivan, we got you first.
All right, thank you. Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ivan Maluski with Friends of Family Farmers. We represent small and mid-sized family farmers across Oregon. We work to build strong local and regional food systems and to ensure that family-scale agriculture remains viable in our state today and in the future. We're submitting this testimony today in support of House Bill 2729 to fund the Oregon Ag Heritage Program. I wanted to point out that we first began, while we shared some of Representative Post's concerns about the bill last year and were concerned about some of the administrative costs, the fact is we actually began supporting working lands conservation easements as a tool to protect farmland and family farm viability nearly a decade ago. The issue is identified through our farmer and rancher listening sessions that we held across the state beginning in 2009. It was among many priority action items highlighted in our 2010 Agricultural Reclamation Act, a roadmap to sound agricultural policies written by Oregon's family farmers and ranchers. In the face of issues such as growing corporate and out-of-state ownership of Oregon's farms, consolidation in the farming sector, rising land prices, and aging farmer population and development pressures, many farmers identified the need to protect the continuity of viable and existing farmland, as well as a need for greater assistance in helping pass land and farm businesses to the next generation. Solutions to these challenges included practical conservation easements that are designed to protect farmland and financial and succession planning necessary to transfer these businesses to the next generation. So while we are supportive of this bill and the funding ask, we want to urge the legislature to keep a keen eye on this program and how the funds are spent in future years, being open to making adjustments in the future if necessary to help prioritize limited funds. During the summer of 2018, we commented on the proposed rules for the program, and we suggested a number of ways to prioritize funding to ensure a focus on farmland affordability, access to land for beginning farmers and socially disadvantaged producers, and to limit the ability of out-of-state owners and real estate investment firms to receive funds from the program. Many of our suggested rule changes were not adopted, and we remain concerned that clear prioritization of program funds may still be needed to achieve these goals, but we are supportive of the bill. Thank you.
Chair Clam, members of the committee, for the record, Peter Kanagi, Benton County. I'm here to encourage you to move this forward. This is a bill that I wish there was no need for, but the fact is there is a need for it. And, you know, $10 million is peanuts compared to what the governor has in her budget for affordable housing. And farmland is a much bigger proportion of the landscape than housing. And, you know, I have concerns about how the whole thing will work out, but it's something I think we need to get started at, and hopefully it can be improved and be a workable program. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Klim, members of the committee. For the record, Mary Ann Cooper here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. I will be brief, but we were one of the organizations that sat on the work group that created the Oregon Agricultural Heritage Program. So we have been an integral part of the program from day one. I think we have several members sitting on the commission, and it is a program that I think Peter said it well. You know, we wish there wasn't a need for it, but we do have members that are interested in it, and certainly as we're looking at the amount of farmland that is going to change hands in the coming decades, it is critically important that we ensure that this farmland stays in agricultural production and that there are programs like this available for those producers who want to use them. I think our members know this isn't necessarily going to be for every producer, but for some producers, it could mean keeping their land in production, keeping it intact, and keeping some of our very important working landscapes that provide wildlife, water quality, and economic value to our state, keeping them intact and making sure that they're able to be passed to the next generation. And this is critically important. To a few of the points that Ivan mentioned, I do think that this committee can take quite a bit of comfort in the commission that Maida and Bruce outlined and that Bruce is serving on. That commission is made up of family farmers and ranchers, conservation interests, and others that are going to work to ensure that just the projects that really do kind of hit the sweet spot of what we want to see preserved, what we want to see protected in the state, are the ones that get funded and are the ones that move forward that have that working lands conservation balance, are looking at intergenerational transfer and other land preservation issues that are so critical. And so I think we can take comfort in that was probably one of the most hotly contested and well-discussed issues was the makeup of that commission. And given the work that they did last summer, I think we can feel pretty good that we got it correct and that they really are going to fund only those projects that are truly worthy of state funds and truly hit that sweet spot of conservation and working lands and all of the goals of the program. So thank you.
Any questions? So the one, maybe a couple of comments I'd make, back in 2013, I think maybe Mr. Cleave in the back there was in your seat at the time, and Peter will definitely remember some of these conversations. We had a lot of discussion about conservation and farmers and conflicts about you're buying land, you're taking off the tax rolls, or your wetland creation is getting into my business, and I mean, I sponsored myself a bill. I just had to go look it up. 2173 that made creation of wetlands a conditional use, which was not so popular in certain sectors. But it was all kind of about the same issue, which is how do we get along better between conservation and ag, because we all want the same goals. And at the time, I remember thinking these working easements are kind of the solution, but who knew if that was actually going to take off? Ivan's group did have a report that said it should be even before that. But we were trying to get to some sort of consensus. So I'm just so pleased that everybody went down that road instead of getting people like me to sponsor bills that, you know, pick sides, basically, because this really solves a lot of problems to have people still have their lands in production and be able to afford to leave it that way. And it just, we haven't heard those same wars for a long time. And, you know, Peter and I started talking about these things when I had hair and you had no gray hair at the Mill Museum, like the old Best Western deal out there in like 2003, I mean, a long time ago. So I just am really pleased where we're at now. And the one thing I did not know when we were talking about this, that I would actually firsthand see what if we had money, what would have been a really helpful thing, because when we had discussions with our family members about our orchard, I think I've mentioned before, we went and got an appraisal and to try and pick a value to decide if someone wanted to still farm and somebody didn't, who buys who out and at what value, and it was 40% higher for under the current land use laws, it was 40% higher to sell it for development value than to whole farm value. And so somebody had to walk away from a ton of money, and, you know, there were hurt feelings, people negotiating, and none of that, all that could be avoided if there were a way to say, hey, there's this other program that helps pay that delta so you all don't have to decide who's going to get mad at the other one. And we just ended up making the decision, and my wife and her sister are kind of saintly, and they just said, fine, we'll just forget about the Delta, and you guys keep farming, and so, but a lot of strained feelings in a lot of farm families over this question. And in the future, those particular four parcels, I believe, may still end up in this program, because there's no next generation after our current cousin, and I hope that they don't just become view lots in the Hood River Valley for somebody. But they need money to make sure that doesn't happen, because it'll go to some other party, and it's worth a lot more to just make view lots, frankly, and then lease it out to some grower, hopefully, but maybe not. So I had no idea I would have a practical firsthand view of what it would mean to a family to be able to lubricate the transaction with some help to keep it a whole farm. But it would help significantly. So I think maybe Dylan brought me this bill, actually, and said, let's make it a committee bill. I said, I think people are going to want to sign on to this one. And so Representative Witt and I and a lot of other co-sponsors took a little bit of a leap of faith that we were going to work it out, because we weren't sure yet if everybody was all on the same page. But it is really heartwarming to see where we're at now. But we need to fund it. That's the bottom line. Okay. With that, I am going to, someone else is here. I don't see anybody on my list. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2729. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill. Do you want to, Representative Brock-Smith, do you want to talk about both of them together, or do you want to do one at a time? Okay, so let's open public hearings. When I call up other people, I'll do them separately, but just for your, save you time, let's talk about House Bill 20, let me open a public hearing on House Bills 2357 and House Bill 2363. And ask Representative Brock-Smith to talk about his two bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and colleagues of the committee. David Brock-Smith, State Representative, House District 1, which is Charleston, wraps around Coos Bay to West Roseburg, West I-5 to West Cape Junction, over back over the coast to the California border. We're going to start with House Bill 2357. As you can see very clearly, House Bill 2357 helps define standing for appeal, land use appeals in the state of Oregon. Having, of course, grown up and have held many elected officials' hats through local government, from city council to school board to county commissioner, I have dealt with a number of bad actors, if you will, with regards to organizations that like to file appeals on land use decisions that halt any progress, really, within our county. There is some good actors, since I've been in this building and working with them, and a lot of them are here and behind me. And I appreciate the conversations that we have and the ability to discuss matters and really come up with solutions. Some bad actors, like ORCA, for example, Oregon Coast Alliance, are not so solutions oriented. In fact, when discussed with them, they have told me they don't negotiate, they litigate. And those are the bad actors that we're trying to fix here with this piece of legislation. Because what happens is whenever a project, well, let me back up. In rural Oregon, we have the ability and the land and the desire to want to develop under the current land use system that we have. In fact, we carved out a bill here for one of those projects that I approved as the chairman of the Board of Curry County Commissioners for the Pacific Hills Golf Project in 2013 as a county commissioner. They did not finish the appellate process brought forth by ORCA until last summer, which cost the developer of the project almost $500,000 in fees throughout the process, and the folks at ORCA filing the appeal never once had to show up at a hearing and drive down to Gold Beach, and deal with that at all. And they would send in their documents when the deadline would be 5 o'clock on a Friday at 4:55. or they would send in more information to the Board of Commissioners at 9 o'clock in the morning prior to the 10 o'clock meeting, to which would then halt the process because the commissioners would then need to review the documents according to staff, because the County Planning Department doesn't have the resources to deal with these type of appeals. And so it takes them much longer, because there's only 1.5 people in the office to deal with them. And so whenever any development, I would like to argue that whenever in any development is wanted, or any developer wants to come in and bring a project into our rural Oregon counties, they look at the prior problems that other folks have had in the future, and they just say, you know what, we don't want to deal with it. We don't want to put $500,000 into a permitted use into a project before we can even turn a shovel, because of the appellate process through the state. In fact, I've talked to others that are in this body that have not lived in Oregon and have moved here, that were surprised that in Oregon, somebody in Wallala County can hear about a land use project in Harper, Oregon, and file an appeal, and never have to once be present or really put out any effort other than that appellate email for the appeal to start the process. So what this bill does is it has the appellant put some skin in the game, to where they need to actually live near the project, which is a novel thought, to be impacted by the project in one way or another. And they need to show up at the land use hearing to file their appeal, rather than sit behind a desk in Eugene or Astoria to do so, or sit behind a computer in Wallala County. That's the crux of the bill. I'm not beholden to the within 25 miles boundary. I'm open to any amendments that my colleagues on the committee would be interested in. But when it comes to the bad actors, and I would hope the good actors in the room can understand this and maybe put some pressure on the bad actors that file these land use appeals on even permitted use projects, especially in these rural counties that don't have the resources to deal with the process, the appellate process in the first place. Again, 5 years to permit a golf course. In fact, it was permitted, but through the appellate process, 5 years for a permitted use on a project, $500,000. I'm open to any questions.
Mr. Chair, one for us.
What's that?
One for us.
So I have a question. Let me see if they're going to talk. I was just looking at my little bill file here, and I've got a list. They're not going to testify. So, you know, we've got a little letter from the DLCD, and they're wondering if you intended to apply to them, I think.
Of course not.
Okay. Right now, they're not currently in there.
I saw the letter.
Yeah. So they were just mentioning they have a lot of offices, but not always within 25 miles.
Of course.
Okay. That's my only question for the moment.
Mine's
Vice Chair Post, and then.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine's more for probably for you and I than anybody. So I'm going to include you on this.
Okay.
If that's all right. Does this have anything to do with the Costco in Salem? I mean, will it help? Will it help me get my Costco in Salem?
Oh.
Can you Mr. somehow, Chair, can we put
we have a
in
Costco
there?
In Salem. No. It's in my district. I like it right where it's at.
They're appealing.
And Salem and Kaiser in the same UGB, and we're going to stay there.
They're appealing to move, and they're appealing to Luba, and I just...
Do you want him to move?
Yes.
No, it's good where it's at. The
parking's horrible.
I know, it's in my district. It's a lot. Oh, my Lord. Sorry.
Vice Chair Post, I don't know the details of your Costco.
Bruglio.
Your Costco conundrum. But if, in fact, there is an appeal and the person under the current language was appealing within 20, and they have to live within 25 miles, they would have to be present at the hearing, the land use hearing, to file that appeal.
I can rest for now.
Representative Helm.
Mr. Chair, hello, my friend.
No.
This is a rhetorical question. You can only imagine how uncomfortable this bill makes me feel.
Of course.
And for those that are listening, this has been my line of work in the past, where we provide representation to folks all around the state that care about our natural resources and our land uses. And my question is this. It has been the law of the land in Oregon that for many, many years, that persons that may be potentially aggrieved of a local decision will have the right to participate, and then by virtue of participation in one form or another, then have standing to appeal either to the Land Use Board of Appeals and then on up into our appellate courts. And I wonder, have you asked our Department of Justice or our LC what the repercussions of reducing it to such a small circle around the subject property that's the issue at hand in the land use proceeding might do to that that participation?
So, and Bruce Miller from Oregon Judicial Department is here and will testify in a little bit in case you need their feedback too.
I do need their feedback. My understanding is it does not limit the participation in the process, but in order for the appeal to occur, these parameters that would have to be met. So the appeal would have to come from someone that has a residence or business within 25 miles of the land use decision, and also then file and then also be present at the land use hearing in order to give to file the appeal. And then the process would move forward. It does not take away standing for anyone from Wallala County to come down and support through testimony the ability. But in order for the appeal to be filed, they must drive from Wallala County to Brookings, Oregon, if that's the scenario, in order to be present at the hearing to do so. So they just can't sit behind their desk in Wallala County, type it up, and hit send in an email. So they have to put some skin in the game when it comes to filing these appeals on land use decisions throughout the state.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up and then two.
In order to do that, the way that I read the bill right now, you would have to substantially amend it to make that the case because of the word resident. So I'll just note that for both of you.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Helm, so I believe the resident language has to do with the person resides or maintains a place of business within 25 miles of the boundary, correct?
Vice Chair McClain.
I think this is a question that wants, or that's asking for you to prioritize. To me, there's two very different parts to this bill. There's the part, who has standing? Okay, that's a long, a going conversation. And there's debatable issues on all sides of many different scenarios for sideboards. But the other one is that you have to be in a place to have any kind of input or any kind of, you have to be at whatever the physical place is. And we've worked just really hard in the last 3 to 4 years to make sure people who are in Eastern Oregon or people who are in Southern Oregon have an opportunity to participate through other modes rather than just be in Salem or be at the Capitol. So I guess I want to know if you think both of those are equally as important to you, or if there are amendable issues on both sides of that bill, both the standing elements and sideboards, and then also the physical presence.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Vice Chair, I appreciate the question. To me, the standing would be more important, but I see the but there's a nexus between the two. And the reason I say that is, again, using the Wallala County and then Brookings scenario, if there was no standing, the resident in Wallala County did not have standing to file an appeal against Brookings, and therefore there would be no reason for them to be present at the hearing, and therefore they wouldn't be able to file the appeal. That doesn't mean that the resident in Wallala County doesn't have a sister that lives in Brookings that is equally upset about the situation, and therefore has standing and the ability to file an appeal within the jurisdiction of boundaries of the legislation. My problem again is, and I hope I'm answering your question, because I see the nexus of the two, because if there wasn't any standing, then the second part wouldn't really exist.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions? We've got three more and Bruce Miller. Okay. Do you want to talk about the other one now, or do you want to just do it after?
We can real quick if you'd like.
So that's 2363.
Representative David Brock Smith, House District 1, Southwest Oregon. We are moving to discuss House Bill 2363. If you remember, in 2017, then Representative Leininger and I chief sponsored the bill that defined historic homes. It was a good piece of legislation. This bill, as you can see, just changes the date of what the definition of historic home is from 1945 to 1974. And the date that is important because of the dates that the land use laws and came into effect within our state. And so basically I want to redefine that historic home language as it pertains to this piece of legislation to the homes that are built prior to 1974, when our state land use laws came into effect and the codes and so forth associated with.
And this is specifically about ADUs. The bill is from last session was, or two sessions ago, I can't remember now, Representative Leininger's bill about ADUs.
And so just the base bill talks about the accessory dwelling unit on rural residential property of two or more acres. You can't partition, you still have to follow the same land use laws with regards to septic, with regards to water, with regards to everything associated with the laws of the land. This was just change that ability to have the original house 1974 built prior to 1974.
And sorry, just to revisit the bill, because some people either weren't here or don't remember, and I'm already forgetting. That's how foggy my memory gets. The theory was, if somebody was going to do an ADU and they had a historic home, we'd rather they turn that into the ADU than rip it down. So if they have a housing right to build a home, we don't want them to use their replacement dwelling right to rip that one down and put another one up. We would rather just have them make an ADU out of the historic home and then build the one that they want rather than tear it down.
Correct. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And also, this is planning for, I have a lot of old folks that live in my district and around the state that their children, you know, are interested in coming home rather than their family members going into an assisted living facility. They have the means and the potential to build a new home on their property, but their home wasn't built before 1945. And so they want to come home, take care of their mother and father. They don't want to live with them. And they have the ability to build a secondary dwelling right next door to them and be able to take care of them through the end of their life.
Questions? Okay. I will, of course, listen to the testimony from Peggy Lynch, but I will just give you, flag you for you where I'm at, sort of. We are going to have an ADU bill coming over, I hope still. I'm confident there's going to be something that comes over. I would prefer to entertain this in the context of what else is happening in ADU land. As you know from our conversation in the House lounge, I don't really think of the 70s as historic yet, and we're getting there, but not yet. And the other thing I think would be good for committee members, and it's only because I've been here a long time that I know this stuff, I would want people to know in the context of other things we've done to give people those kinds of dwellings for their family member, like Measure 49, that was what 37 was often about, so a lot of people got either one, two, or three for that, or what other, actually they could sell them if they wanted to. So I think people need to know what you currently can do to get a family member, accessory dwelling, hardship dwelling, family dwelling. There's a whole bunch of other ways to get dwellings too. So I want them to hear what all you can get to know whether or not we need another one in the context of what's already gonna become in the ADU bill for outside the UGB, which I'm not totally sure, but I think something. Yes. I'm pretty sure something.
I'm not sure yet either.
Yeah. But anyway, that's kind of where I'm at for now on this one, but I just wanted to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Okay, so let's return to 2357, and then Peggy, I'm gonna have you come last so you can cover both bills, because you're the only person on 2363. So back to 2357, the standing, Mary Cal McCurdy, Mary Ann Cooper, and Bruce Miller. Mary Kyle, got you up first.
Good afternoon, other members of the committee. Mary Kyle McCurdy with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. We oppose 2357. As you've already heard, it limits standing and land use appeals to those who live or own a business within 25,000 boundaries of local government that making the land use decision, and they must also have appeared before the decision maker in person if there is a local hearing. This bill is contrary to the very core of Oregon's land use planning program, Goal 1, citizen participation, which, quote, ensures the opportunity for citizens to be involved in all phases of the planning process. It might also run afoul of due process requirements. The impacts of many land use decisions, whether adverse or beneficial, do not stop at jurisdictional boundaries. For example, a land use decision may impact roads, streams, and even the housing market beyond the boundary of the local actual decision. Some land use decisions have a fiscal impact on every Oregonian. And really, many Oregonians do not have the time, the financial means, or the physical ability to travel to a local hearing, whether they live 2 miles or 200 miles from the site of the decision. And while perhaps not the intent, this bill would also limit the ability of an out-of-town landowner who applies for a development permit and gets denied to appeal that local decision if they were unable to attend the local hearing. I believe it's a very slippery slope and undesirable one to start making laws to limit people's ability to participate because they are viewed as bad actors. Under the land use program, they must participate and raise any issue at the local level that they might want to raise on an appeal. That is very clear. We have everyone come in at the beginning, raise their issues, and then if they want to go further, they have to have done that. And that participation today includes the ability to do so in writing. Other people's bad actors, often developers who we are often associated with and are often on the same side as, and sometimes not, but they've also been known to be bad actors and to bring things into the record at the last minute. I really don't want to start characterizing people who take the time to care about Oregon, wherever that part in Oregon is. And I'd like to just frame the issue. There are very few actual appeals of local land use decisions to LUBA. Of the 15,000 or so estimated local land use decisions made each year, only about 150 or so are appealed to LUBA, and far fewer go to the Court of Appeals. I don't want to see a lot of litigation if this bill would pass just on what the meaning of standing is and who has it. So I think the current system is working actually very well. Is it perfect? No, but democracy isn't perfect. Public participation isn't perfect. So we ask you to oppose this bill. Thank you.
All right.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Mary Ann Cooper here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. We are also opposed, and I will lead in by saying that we've heard concerns in a lot of communities across Oregon, a lot of places where members are cited about people coming in from outside the community and participating in decisions. So I definitely can fully understand and relate to the concern that this bill is seeking to address of wanting kind of local decisions to stay in the community. However, we often participate for our local membership and land use planning decisions. We rarely appeal, but we do on occasion. And we often participate, well, we only participate if requested by our County Farm Bureau, but those are also entities, and I'm guessing that our seat of business would be in Salem, Oregon, which would prevent us from participating really in any decision or appeal beyond probably whatever's 25 miles from about a mile north of here. So for our membership who wants us to continue to be able to engage for them at the local level and continue to be able to work on these decisions at the local level, we didn't notice anything for kind of organizational standing or anything in the bill. And so we have concerns about our ability to continue to participate on behalf of our members, on behalf of our local county farm bureaus and land use decisions around the state. So thank you.
Bruce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm special counsel to the State Court Administrator. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department, which includes the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, the Tax Court, and the Circuit Courts. We don't have a position on the bill, but I wanted to raise a technical issue with you that you may want to consider should you choose to move the bill along. We can see an issue occurring in a land use process that's already begun when the bill takes effect. And in that instance, a citizen may have complied with the current standing requirements and statute. And then the bill goes into effect on January 1 before the time to appeal is run. That may create confusion for the citizen, for the Land Use Board of Appeals, and for the Court of Appeals over whether the citizen has proper standing to appeal. They did when they appeared before the local body. They don't now that the bill is in effect. If you choose to go forward, you may want to consider an applicability clause or addressing that issue in some other manner to avoid the confusion and to avoid litigation of issues that don't relate to the substantive issues that are at stake in the appeal. Thank you for your time.
So Bruce, can I just freelance here? I've got a question. About, I don't know, 6 years ago, yeah, it's about my legal troubles, no, just kidding. About 6 years ago, there was a work group on Senate Bill 7, no, God, 9 years ago now? 9 years ago, there was a work group that I was on Senate Bill 766, which was about speeding development in the inside the urban growth boundary. And at the time, I brought up, somebody asked me to bring up standing. At that time, two esteemed gentlemen, rogues named John Chandler and Tom Gallagher said, yeah, we've tried that for like 20 years. You're never going to get anywhere. Don't even bother trying. I think it's unconstitutional. So I gave up on even looking into it. But how does standing work with a court? So if we try and pass a statute, clearly courts determine who has standing or not. But isn't there a constitutional like right to petition your government that they hold against whether if the legislature says you don't have standing? And somebody else wants to sue that law to say, yes, I do. I'm from this state and I go to the coast. The courts would take a constitutional challenge that you can't limit standing, or how do the courts come up with who has standing or not?
Mr. Chair, first they look to statute, and you have many statutes that establish what creates standing. There are certainly occasions where someone may say, that statute violates my due process rights, in which case the court may weigh in on the constitutionality of it. But a lot of the standing decisions are set in statute and in case law that already exists.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So legislatures do try and set criteria for standing, and then if people think it infringes on their constitutional rights, they challenge those statutes.
Mr. Chair, that's right. And in fact, you've established standing in this instance. The current statute has standing requirements in it. this bill would change those requirements, but you have created, the Assembly has created standing requirements for these appeals.
Okay, that helps. Okay, other questions? Anyone else have legal troubles? Yeah, Representative Helm.
Not really a question, but just to, I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't bring this resource to the committee's attention, because if I don't, it'll never be used by another committee on another bill. And that is...
And somebody went to a lot of work to make this resource.
Yes, this resource comes out of Senate Bill 77, I think probably sometime prior to 2013, and it requires the Land Use Board of Appeals to track and provide a report on all of the LUBA appeals by quarter. And that tracking started in 2013, and it goes through currently. I had occasion to look at this earlier this year, and in general, it confirms what Ms. McCurdy said about overall numbers of LUBA appeals. But it's there for our use. I commend it to your use.
It's the Senate Bill 77 LUBA appeals database.
Yes.
That this is the first four clicks that it's ever received. That's not true. I know, like, Peggy's probably in there every night reading it. There's a few. Aaron's in there, and Alan. Oh. Okay. Okay, further questions for this group? No. Okay, thank you. And then, Peggy, can you come talk to us about both bills? And then there were some nice five gentlemen in this case from my office, in my office earlier, inviting us all to go to the RAM, where the people who don't want us to raise their beer taxes, also known as the Brewers of Oregon, seem to be having a reception, if anyone's interested. And they said, can you please get out of your committee early? I said, not until we hear from Peggy Lynch. And with that...
I need to move along.
No, never say that, because I have Joint Committee on Student Success till 7, so I'm not going anyway.
Oh. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be last, because in starting with the first bill, the standing bill, you heard most of the appropriate arguments against the bill. And I can also mention to through Representative Helm that the LUBA budget that was just heard continues to provide those reports every session as they work to explain the purpose of LUBA and how successful it has been since we created that quick way to move through appeals process. I looked through my files, and I found a 2004 paper, Governor Kulongoski's Regulatory Streamlining group, that talked about this issue.
The Reset Cabinet.
Yes, in part. And I attended those as well. It is also apparent to the group that other remedies of appeal to the circuit court would be available as an alternative remedy. Further experience with such alternate circuit court appeals prior to the formation of LUBA led many of us to believe that this remedy may prove more time-consuming and unpredictable than the developed LUBA process. Consequently, modification of standing requirements to raise the bar for filing of land use appeals may prove to offer limited benefits and would be at the expense of historic opportunities for full participation in the land use process. In addition, a more technical standing requirement at LUBA would likely lead to greater debate as to who has standing and would force people to use lawyers earlier in the process, lawyers on all sides, by the way, at the local level in order to protect their standing to appeal later at the LUBA level, all of which would not necessarily lead to a simpler or more expedited appeals process. I think that really sort of clarifies, at least for me, why we oppose this bill. We don't think it really accomplishes what the representative really would like to see accomplished. And so we ask that you oppose this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions on standing. If not, I'll move on to House Bill 2363, which changes the date when an ADU, when a historic home would be considered historic, from 1945 to 1974. Having worked on House Bill 3012, when it was first filed, Restore Oregon was the historic group that came before the body to argue the case that they really needed to make sure that we did not lose truly historic homes. So in understanding their issues, some of us, and I have my notes from the 3012 process, that talked about, okay, then we need to talk about wells, we need to talk about septics, we need to talk about all of the other things that are a part of rural Oregon development that people need to understand. So that was included in 3012. I do not see a reason to consider house bills between 1945 and 74 to be historic homes. I would also like to say that in many cases we had zoning ordinances before we had Senate Bill 100. And so it's hard for me to know whether or not the people that Representative Brock Smith is concerned about would really have had an opportunity during that 1945 to 1974 time period, because there were zoning ordinances that occurred. And with that, I ask that you oppose House Bill 2363, and I'd be happy to answer any questions on that one.
Any questions for Peggy?
Oh, good, you can go get your beer.
Okay. Any further committee business? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bill 2363. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2061. Anything else for the good of the order? We have too many cougars in Oregon. Thank you, and I'll adjourn the committee.